From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman. You're listening to Good Food. As I record this on Wednesday, I can say without reserve that this week looks to be historic and stirring in the way your insides get when righteous anger mixes with frustration. It can be a poisonous brew. So let's take an hour together to breathe deep and set those punitive New Year's resolutions aside. Instead, let's look at the power a tiny seed has to reset your outlook. I have a garden that over the years has been in various stages of functionality. At the beginning of 2020, it was lying fallow, and then March happened. Actually, the day we were told to go into lockdown was the first day of Tomato Mania's annual tomato seedling sale. I flew across town to buy soil, seedlings, and pots because some part of me knew I would need an activity so as not to go mad. 10 months and 20 pots of vegetables later, I thought that maybe I could entice you to join me in putting seed to soil, even if it's in a pot. Our guide today is Kazi Patelka. Kazi is a dear friend and an insanely talented gardener on a scale I can just dream about, but I look to her for advice on how to garden. Hi, Kazi.
Hi, Evan.
Are you harvesting anything this week?
I'm harvesting a lot of greens, salad greens. I'm picking my first mandarins, which are the quiches, and I love them. And then that'll roll on through to May.
Yeah, you're lucky. You have this enormous plot of land that most of us could just dream of, those of us who live in Southern California. And you have a lot of fruit trees. The two of us kind of represent the different extremes of what is possible. You have this unusual amount of backyard in which you've basically created an urban farm. I have a small mid-city backyard that's almost entirely concrete. You garden in the ground, I garden in pots. But there's a lot that we have in common about what we have to do. So let's talk about the number one most important thing to planting a garden, whether it's in the ground, a raised bed, or a container. What would that be?
Well, for me, it would be soil. It would be the quality and the care of the soil. Obviously, light and water are almost equally as important. But if your soil isn't rich, you won't have success. And of course, for potting, that's something that you need to decide what you're going to purchase, because premium and potting soils, which is what you really should get, are not cheap.
So what are premium bagged soils? What are we looking for in general that these bags would contain versus what they don't contain?
Well, I think the premium soils contain some manure, some worm casting, some pretty high quality compost materials. So I would say that they're more rich in nutrients than the cheapest varieties. But those can run you $10 to $15 a bag. And you can get potting soil for less than $10 a bag. But in my experience, it's not as good. But one way you can save money is to buy a cheaper potting soil like LGM, which is not too bad, and mix it with a premium potting soil. The other way to save money is to get your friends together with a pickup truck and go to one of the bulk soil places that exist.
The thing that I would exhort people to not use are the blends that include sludge as their nitrogen source. So that would be sewage sludge. And there's heavy metals and things that you really don't want to have your lovely vegetable roots sitting in. So we have our soil. Let's talk about container size, because I think that the size of the container really has a lot to do with what kind of success that we have.
Yes, I think that's very true, Evan. it's important for them to have enough soil, not only to balance out the size of the plant, but also to keep the roots cool. So a bigger pot is always better. But you can still grow smaller plants and container-specific varieties of vegetables in a 5-gallon pot or even in a smaller one. Tomatoes, I would probably put in a 15-gallon pot.
The thing that I really love to do, too, with containers is maybe you just have one plant, if it's a small pot, and you treat it almost like a flower, so it has like its own little pride of place.
That's a lovely idea.
So does it matter what the containers are made out of?
Each type of container has its advantage and its disadvantage. A thick terracotta container has more insulation for keeping the soil cool, but it also evaporates through the terracotta. The water evaporates, excuse me. But a plastic container, like those nursery containers, so you have to really think about placement. That's why it's a really good idea to put your pots in a cluster and to think about whether there's strong afternoon sun hitting that black plastic.
What do we need to do to prep a container so that we know that the plant is going to get good drainage?
Drainage is so important. So you have to make sure that you have some rocks or some landscaping fabric or something at the bottom of the pot that's going to assure that the water can leave the pot if there's a lot of water in there. As it moves through the soil, it'll leave the pot. I've used landscaping fabric. I use shards of old pots. I use rocks. They're everywhere in my San Gabriel Mountain garden.
So now let's say that we've chosen our container. We have beautiful soil, and we're trying to decide what to plant and how to plant. So should we start with seeds or seedlings?
All the leafy greens, I always start from seed. When I have the time, I'll start things like peppers and eggplant and tomatoes from seed. But I mean, with Tomato Mania, how can you go wrong? For years, I've bought all my tomato plants from Tomato Mania. And I often buy my peppers and eggplants in as plants.
So we have our pots, we have the soil. What about placement?
This is an interesting question because you would answer it a little differently if you lived in Malibu or if you lived in Arcadia. Because on the west side with the ocean air, you have less heat. You can grow things that need cool weather for a longer amount of time. Whereas near the mountains, because we have our microclimates, you need to really protect your pots from sun.
So Southern California is very unusual because we have basically two growing seasons, unlike a lot of the country that have frosts that many of us don't have to contend with. So how is there a guide that we can look to that tells us what we can plant here in Southern California each month?
The one that you and I have talked about that we found was out of Santa Monica College. And if you Google a Southern California vegetable planting guide, that one comes up pretty predominantly.
So, you know, every January, a lot of us who are into gardening get all these seed catalogs, and they really are the pornography of gardening because you just can go crazy ordering seeds that you end up never planting or that are completely wildly inappropriate for your area. But one of the things that's so interesting is just to look at all the choices that you have to make when you're looking at these seed catalogs. So if you are going to do a container garden, obviously you want to look for varieties that are geared to containers. And oftentimes those are not heirloom varieties. Those can often be hybrids. So with all the hype around heirloom seeds and the goodness they give us of open pollination, is there a reason to not get hybrid seeds?
No, there is no reason not to buy those. We're not talking about industrial agriculture hybridizers. We're talking about seed companies that are trying to select for tomatoes that are more disease resistant, maybe than the heirlooms from before.
We could keep talking for hours on this, but I just want to say thank you so much for coming on, and hopefully we have inspired some people who have never thought of putting a seed into soil to do it. You can start even with a little terracotta pot that you get at a home gardening shop.
That sounds wonderful. I hope that someone this summer will be eating a salad because of this conversation.
Wouldn't that be fabulous?
Yes, it would.
Thank you so much, Kazi.
All right, bye-bye, Evan.
That was Kazi Patelka. You can follow her on Instagram at LA Kitchen Garden. Up next, looking for another way to wipe the slate clean? Look no further than your kitchen sink. A much-needed lesson in how to wash the dishes is next.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food. For many, the beginning of the year is a way to wipe the slate clean. There is a way to do this in your own home at least once a day. It's called doing the dishes. Those of us without machines find any excuse not to do them. But once you do and the sink is clean, it creates a flow that spills over to the rest of the day.
Washing the dishes in a sink with clean, warm water is a luxury. If you've ever lived without clean running water or warm water, or even if you've ever camped in the wilderness, you already know this. It is also a task of order and of health and hygiene. The kitchen is an operating room, and although you may not always be the one operating, you are the one cleaning up after a kind of surgery. You have all the surfaces and all the equipment to scrub and make ready for the next use. You may be lucky enough to have a dishwasher. The dishwasher is the express train, but your kitchen sink, that's the local.
That's the one and only Peter Miller, a true individual. Peter owns an architecture and design bookshop in Seattle called Peter Miller Books. Fortunately for us, he's also a writer, and his latest book is a personal favorite. It's called How to Wash the Dishes. Hi, Peter.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm fine. This book is one of the most delightful things we have seen, or not one of the most. This is the most delightful book we have seen so far this year.
Oh, Evan, keep it up. I'm so pleased. I'm so pleased you've read it. It's a great pleasure to write something, and it's a much greater pleasure to have somebody read it and like it.
So where do we begin? What is at the center of every scrubbing up?
I mean, really at the bottom center is, you know, is the drain, is literally the ability of the sink to drain. But then at the center of as it actually goes is this bowl of soapy dishwater.
So we're talking about washing the dishes in a sink.
Yeah.
So instead of just washing each individual thing with a sponge and using up a huge amount of water.
And soap.
We start with a bowl of soapy water.
Mm-hmm.
But the object is to still have access to the drain and still have a little area that you can put things that are dirty.
Yes, and have a place to pre-rinse, have a place to see that the water's going out, you know, have a place to, you know, work on a sharp knife.
Because one of the main objects is to keep that bowl of soapy water as pristine as one can for as long as one can.
Yes, you may change it, you know, 4, 5, 6 times if it's a complicated enough meal, but really its only strength until it becomes gray and weak, is that it delivers, you know, a strong solution of soap and hot water, which you can then use to get, you know, grease or olive oil or those kind of things off.
I always put a glug of vinegar in mine, too.
Oh, good for you. It's a really good idea.
So do you have a preference of a type of soap you use, liquid, crystal, or powder?
I use liquid. I've tried a million different kinds. I use Common Good right now because I think it's the best on the market. I think it cuts the best, and I think it doesn't have that terrible difficulty of a smell that sort of trails you. There are soaps on the market that advertise their smell, but if the smell, if it's still on your hands when you're done, you know, cleaning, it just seems like a terrible idea to me.
Do you like to have your soap out just in the container it came in, or do you like to decant?
You're stepping into my country. I love decanting. I love decanting milk because I hate all the information on the side of the cartons, and also think you keep track of the milk better. I really love decanting soap because you can put it into something completely clear with a better pump, and you can see if you're running out.
So what do we go with for cleaning? A sponge or a dishcloth?
You know, I've always used a sponge, but a couple of trips to visit my daughter in Stockholm, and, you know, they would never use a sponge there because you can't clean it well enough for them. So they use a dishcloth, and it's probably converted me now to a dishcloth. I still love the natural sponge. I love how it feels. I love how it can get into a wine glass, but so can this dishcloth. And the Swedes and lots of other countries, the Danes and the Swedes, have come up with a sort of cellulose structure that's completely sustainable. If you want to clean it, you boil it in water for 2 minutes and then hang it up. They don't even put it in a washing machine. They simply boil the darn thing and then leave it to dry, and then it's completely free of bacteria. You know, because I do still love a natural sponge. If you do use a natural sponge, then you have the caution of having to make sure it doesn't sour on you, which it will do if you leave soap in it. And a wonderful friend of mine from Montana said to me, well, rinse it, rinse your natural sponge, which I thought was a brilliant detail. Then she said, rinse it in cold water, and that will kill the remaining bacteria, and it won't sour.
So when you say natural sponge, you're talking about the ones that come flat and then...
Yeah, the ones that come flat and you add, as soon as the water comes in, they grow up. And I love them. But you have to be careful because they are better at keeping bacteria. You have to, it's sort of like doing the dishes. You have to finish with them at the end of the meal. You have to rinse them. And then her suggestion to rinse them in cold water, I just thought was brilliant.
Could you talk about your love of dish towels and their...
Do you love dish towels?
Oh, I have so many.
Aren't they the greatest? Can't you talk about them?
It's so funny because reading this little book, I saw so much of myself in it. And you realize how important a ritual it is that gets so little attention.
Right.
And yet it's something we do every day.
Every day. Every day, and it's always there, no matter how good your dishwasher is. There are always dishes. That's the bookmark that we put in the book, that there you'll always have Paris and you'll always have dishes. But that if I hold up any of the dish towels to you, you could tell me a story about them.
And you keep two, basically you have two different sets of dish towels.
Yeah, in truth, I probably have four, but let's say two. You have the one my wife, for example, won't let me use. You know, if I reach for it, she takes it back. And she loves them, and she doesn't want them doing that duty. So they're in the kitchen for, you know, the more elegant duties of drying, holding something slightly warm, but not for cooking. And then there's the dish towel that is just a Jeep, just a little truck, and its job is to do whatever is necessary to get that meal on the table.
The very back of the book has a wonderful thought. You say, you will know your state of mind when you wash the dishes, your care or your impatience, your attention or your distraction, you will see yourself at that moment clearly.
Isn't it funny? You do, though. You know, people are so good about trying to learn every technique for how to cook from every culture and civilization. But there's not near that kind of attention to either the prep or to the finish of it. If I'm in my kitchen and a certain thing keeps coming back on the plate, I really start to wonder what was the error on my part or what was the, they didn't like the broccoli.
Yeah, it tells you so much.
Yes. It's when I learned that if you really want to be successful serving squash, you have to serve less and let them come back.
Peter, once again, it's a delight. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Evan. Thanks. Bye.
That was Peter Miller. His delightful manual is How to Wash the Dishes. We ran this story as a repeat in March at the beginning of the pandemic, when a sink full of dishes officially became a marker of the stay-at-home order. As we face the next several months with more of the same, the lessons remain powerful. Next up, we'll hear from Toni Tipton Martin, author of the cookbook Jubilee. This book broadens the African-American food story, Tipton Martin writes in the introduction. It celebrates the enslaved and the free, the working class, the middle class, and the elite. It honors cooking with intentionality and skill for a purpose and with pleasure. The first time I chatted with Toni Tipton Martin was on the occasion of the publication of her extraordinary bibliography of her cookbook collection, The Jemima Code. In Jubilee, Ms. Tipton Martin takes the insides of those books that make up her extraordinary collection and brings us stories and recipes that create what she calls the African-American food story. Hi.
Hi. I'm thrilled to be with you. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you here. Partly because you are a Los Angeles girl.
I know.
You grew up here in L.A., in mid-city, as I understand them, Baldwin Hills. So you lived part of the African-American food story that you wrote about in the Jemima Code and now Jubilee. Yet, you say that your family history was like a mirage before you wrote the Jemima Code. Could you speak about that?
Yeah. You know, growing up in L.A., we lived a very comfortable life, and the soul food experience, as historians have recorded it and cookbooks have defined it, really was not part of my upbringing. And there were small hints of the food in our home. My mom's cooking reflected various priorities for her. There was a Latin American sensibility, as well as her focus on healthy eating and ultimately vegetarianism. And that story was just not being told anywhere else. And so for years, as a food writer, I felt isolated. I felt like my story didn't matter, like it really wasn't real. And so finding the books of the Jemima Code restored my faith in those values that my mother had created at the table.
You know, we talk about provenance when we speak about the importance of bibliographic research and scholarship. And these tracings of lineage and influence are some of the most fascinating aspects to your work for me, especially Jubilee, where by creating your own recipes, you place yourself directly in these lines of provenance. What was it like for you as you chose which stories to tell and which recipes to create? The whole book is this enormous, huge example of this, but maybe could you give an example by talking about the macaroni and cheese recipe and its antecedents?
Well, narrowing down which recipes to include was almost an impossible task. So we conceived of the idea of actually following a recipe throughout time to see what adaptations were made from the cabin or from the plantation kitchen, which were the two experiences African Americans had at the earliest days of our country. And then ultimately use modern cookbook authors' interpretations to help us discern the sustainability of a dish, how long it had been on Black menus, was it still on Black menus? And so macaroni and cheese is one of those. It's a great example because it was present in the hands of James Hemings, who worked in Thomas Jefferson's home and was trained in France. We're able to trace that recipe throughout time to discover the ways that it had been made more and more luxurious on African-American tables to today, where it's loaded with tons of cheese, lots of, some people use eggs, some people use whipped cream-based sauce, some people use sour cream, but the main identifier is this massive amount of cheese.
One of my favorite recipes in the book, and I think it's because when I turned the page and I saw it, it reminded me so much of a dish that my mother made when I was growing up over and over and over again, which was Edna Lewis's roast leg of lamb. Can you talk about this dish and what it brought to you in these different incarnations?
Well, what was one of the most compelling parts for me was the connection of my own family to the leg of lamb. My middle son loves to cook. And when he was in high school, he came to me and said that he and his male friends were going to make the holiday meal for the girls. And they went into my cookbook library and came out with a recipe for roast leg of lamb. And these were, you know, juniors and seniors, I believe. And they produced this incredible lamb using her recipe. And that spoke to my heart, you know, in that if we provided more role models like Miss Lewis for young people, then we could do so much more to inspire them to enjoy cooking, to take better care of their health by cooking. We might inspire them towards food careers in the industry. And so this little story with my own child was just such a great reflection of the opportunity and the possibilities for us all if we just knew more about who these folks were and the ways that they stand as role models because of their culinary values.
I want to turn to this summer. The country and really the entire world seem to awaken to longstanding systemic injustice and racism. And food media became the focus of its own reckoning, sparked by frank revelations on Twitter of mistreatment at marquee publications. Had you already been in conversation with America's Test Kitchen to take over as editor-in-chief for Cook's Country, or did that opportunity arise out of the ferment that happened?
My engagement with America's Test Kitchen occurred in February, actually, because I was invited by a member of their diversity council to bring Jubilee into their campus and to talk about the kinds of things we're talking about today, why it's important to understand and tell more stories about America's diverse culinary history, not just a select part of it.
When can we expect to see your first full issue released?
My first full issue will be the June-July issues, but my first appearance, is April and May. And what we have done there is carry on the tradition that I started with the Jemima Code blog and the tour, which was the focus on cooks, by including a gorgeous, gorgeous portrait of an American cook on our pages. There is no recipe. There is no story. We are just there celebrating his legacy and his importance as a fixture in his restaurant. And that's the first way that you will recognize I'm there because of my passion for cooks. And then ultimately, what I'm hoping is that there will be more features like that.
We're talking to you in the first weeks of a new year, which is always a time for self-reflection and setting new intentions. What stories and perspectives would you like to see more of in 2021, especially coming out of this past year of 2020?
Well, I can't specify stories, but what I can tell you is I would really love to see a shift in philosophy. And as I said a moment ago, I would really love to see us not argue so much over who made a dish first and what its origins are, and spend more time looking at the unique ways that we all contribute our uniqueness to a particular dish. I hope that we will become as comfortable saying things like, that's not the way that my family made that soup, but if you would like to add potatoes to it, that's perfectly fine. You know what I mean? We really should be a lot more gentle with each other in the coming year because we've been through a lot. That's what I would love to see us doing, is nurturing one another more with our food, with our food stories, and just trying to really explore our shared sense of humanity.
It has been such a pleasure getting to have this time with you, Toni. Thank you very much for coming on Good Food.
Thank you so much for having me, Evan. It was great.
That was Toni Tipton Martin, the author of the cookbook Jubilee and the new editor of Cook's Country. In a minute, when a mom insists upon stocking her daughter's fridge during the pandemic, her newlywed daughter doesn't know how to tell her to stop. That's next when Good Food continues. You're listening to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. Dakota Kim is a food writer living in Pasadena. A year ago, she and her husband had their first baby. Before the baby, she'd see her parents maybe once a month. Now they're visiting twice a week. Combine the pandemic, a new baby, with an overly exuberant cook food supplier for a mother, and you have a pandemic fridge war.
257 days. That's how long I've been at home. First I was furloughed, then laid off. And most of that time, I've been squabbling with my mom about a very heated topic. The contents of my fridge.
Mom, how many chameh did you bring last time?
What?
How many chameh did you bring last time?
3-4 of them.
Our weekly dance is a deja vu. She arrives with a laundry basket full of Korean banchan. You know, those small side dishes they serve at Korean barbecue. And I scramble to get out of her way as she charges through my tiny kitchen to the fridge. I peer timidly into the kitchen to see what she's unloading. This time, the haul is a half-gallon glass jar of oi sobagi, spicy cucumber kimchi stuffed with pungent Korean chives. Musangche, a julienned cold radish salad that's crisp, crunchy, and zippy from the vinegar. Totorimuk muchim, a chili pepper-flecked acorn jelly that's wobbly like jello. Hobak namur, a rich sautéed zucchini. Gaji namur, slim purple Korean eggplant from her garden. And no, I'm not even close to done yet, so bear with me. An 8-inch long Tupperware of meontang, a chili pepper red fish stew. A literal pitcher, with a lid, thank God, full of doenjang jjigae, one of my favorite hearty stews. Even homemade bungeoppang, red bean desserts that she presses into a fish shape in her own personal black cast iron press. And let's not even get into the dry goods. We're still trying to work our way through the 20-pound bag of sticky rice sitting on top of our fridge, and enough jars of sesame seeds to open a tahini factory.
A 20-pound bag of rice.
Oh my God, we don't have any room for any of this.
It's definitely going to last us until the end of COVID.
Our modest fridge begins to resemble the kimchi shelf at H Mart as my mom stuffs it with a panoply of rectangular glass dishes, looking for ever more holes to squeeze yet another dish in. All these dishes are amazing on the first, second, and third day. It's when we can't conquer them by the end of the third day that the chives and radishes begin to permeate our fridge with the odors of fermenting vegetables.
Don't buy a lot of groceries, okay? She buys too many groceries and then she's spending too much of her money.
We live for eat.
I yell at her and question why she's spending so much money at Costco and Arirang, money that I know she should save. I feel guilty complaining about this at a time when people are struggling to put food on the table, but her overstuffing of our fridge is threatening the calm of my not even 1-year-old marriage. My husband, a minimalist who could eat the same margarita pizza every night for 40 years, can't take the Jenga that our fridge has become, and we've started to have fights about why I can't stand up to her.
I'm sorry, babe.
What is this stuff back here?
I think that is doenjang.
Can we get rid of it?
It's all become too much. We're spending a few hours every week just cleaning our fridge.
Why do we have, like, 8 things of miso paste?
I don't know. But we definitely have enough japcha to last us until next year.
Look, are we expired
on
this deal?
No, miso lasts forever. Is that, like, 4 jars of kimchi in the back?
Yes, it's... Well, I don't know. Is this kimchi?
Yeah, that's kimchi.
Okay, yeah, I guess it is. What's this?
This
looks like garbage.
Some cucumber kimchi I forgot,
I think
cucumber salad pickles. I forgot about.
What is this? What? What is this? What is any of this?
Oh, this is acorn jelly wrapped in some plastic.
The root cause of my mom's overfeeding is anxiety, both about the past and the present. My mom was born a few years after the Korean War, raised on a struggling rice farm in a small town called Buan. Food like meat, eggs, and milk were sparse, and most people were hungry. My mom started cooking for her family at age 8, helping her mother feed her 6 brothers who worked on the farm. I think modern families are confusing and disorienting to my mom because each nuclear unit is so isolated. Nowadays, there just isn't a village of people to share a massive amount of leftovers with or barter japcha for fish. I recognize that my food security has insulated me from the need to hoard, but my mom's anxiety ramps up with each COVID flare. There's hand-wringing and muttering as she watches the LA-based KBS Korean News at my house, the anchors discussing the latest flare-up in California. Sure enough, after each COVID flare comes a bump in the amount of really, really good for you veggies she brings. If COVID weren't happening and she could be in close contact with people, she'd happily be feeding a village right now, which is what she usually does at her Korean church.
So we have a lot of maeuntang, which is this spicy red pepper fish stew, and Nick and I want to get it out of our fridge, so we were wondering if you wanted some.
Yeah, I want all the Sunny Kim food.
1 weekend while I'm cleaning the fridge, my friend Sarah drops by. Sitting a safe distance apart outside my apartment, I complain to her that Nick and I are fighting about the clogged fridge. I'm surprised when I ask her if she wants any of the leftover Korean fish stew.
I'm tired of cooking, and I'm tired of, like, eating the things that I cook. Like, I haven't been to a restaurant. It's like...
What about some acorn jelly? How do you feel about acorn jelly? Less excited about acorn jelly.
Yeah, less excited. I'll take all of your japchae.
Oh yeah, for sure.
Korean food is delicious, but eating it every week, it's a little bit less exciting than hitting up K-Town for garbitang once a month. I didn't think anyone would want a Tupperware of the spicy tofu I eat every week, but Sarah and her husband Alan, both food writers, are thrilled about our leftovers. Sarah doesn't have a mom nearby cooking for her, but now she has Sunny Kim. She'll never have to haul to K-Town for authentic meals as long as my mom is around.
I can bring you more stuff next time. I have a jar of kimchi.
Now that I've realized how desired my leftovers are, I've got something of a miniature trade economy going. Sarah will take japchae and give me whole cuts of locally farmed sturgeon in exchange. A neighbor from next door has 2 picky sons who love the pajeon, or savory Korean pancakes. In exchange, she gifts me something that won't clog my fridge, but beautifies my table instead. Pink amaryllis flowers from her backyard. And with the canned food, like the 8 giant cans of baked beans my mom shows up with one single day, that can go to our local food pantry. Whatever no one else will take, we carefully dump in a bag, tie up, and throw out in the dumpster that evening. What my mom doesn't know won't hurt her, right? But still, her words ring through my ears with every decision I make.
I am happy when I feed my family. I make healthy food, and especially I come see my daughter often. And I love to making food for them and feed them. When they eat well, and I'm very happy. Especially my grandson, he loves to eat Korean food, and I love to make it. Cook and feed them.
I'd rather see her save the money, but I know feeding us is her therapy right now. Lately, I feel like I'm winning the pandemic fridge wars. My fridge doesn't stink anymore. I can actually find things now. My mom still loves me.
I will, Mom. I was so worried that you were sick.
I feel so much better now.
Yeah. 그리고 내일 아침에 또 치킨 수프 먹는 거 잊지 말고.
Okay, I will.
물 좀 넣어가지고 뿌려가지고 그래. 그리고
that's her telling me to make sure to eat the black garlic, ginkgo, and of course the chicken soup before she leaves my house.
Okay.
너 여섯 개, 니 여섯 개.
Okay.
Love
you guys.
Yeah,
okay, love you.
A tiny little bit of me wishes I could eat just one more bowl of fish stew and make her even happier. In the meantime, let me know if you live in LA and want to pick up some japchae. For Good Food, I'm Dakota Kim.
That was Dakota Kim, a food writer in Pasadena. She produced that story along with Nick Tajan. It was edited by Kristen Lepore as part of KCRW's independent producer project. Speaking of stocking the fridge, it's time for a visit to the farmer's market. Jillian Ferguson is back in Santa Monica this week with her first report of the year.
This is Jillian Ferguson with the Market Report. It is finally feeling like winter at the farmer's market this week. I'm in Santa Monica today with Chef Daniel Patterson, who along with Keith Corbin is a chef at Alta Adams in West Adams. And Daniel, I see you here almost every week picking up boxes of produce. What are you shopping for today?
A lot of things, but in particular, one of the things that we really like to come to the farmer's market for is the gumbo dish that we do at Alta Adams. So it's gumbo with an O-G-O. It's not the traditional New Orleans dish. It's a variant on a West African okra stew. And the stew itself is kind of a base for whatever we find. So in the summer, it might be zucchini and tomatoes and eggplant. In the winter right now, it's whatever we find, which is a lot of brassica, cauliflower, flowering cauliflower, broccoli romanesco. We're starting to see some new onions, which are really beautiful, that we'll char and throw in there. Baby turnips is one of the things, and the dino kale has been amazing.
Wow, so can you walk us through this dish? I love any recipe that you can sort of transform with the seasons. What is at the base, and how do you build up the recipe?
So the recipe itself is based on okra, so it's shallot, okra, spices, and chilies. We use vegetable stock, so it's a vegan dish. People can add shrimp or smoked chicken if they want to have protein, but it's really designed to be a really delicious vegan option served over rice for people that want it. And one of the things that we really love about it, it's a way to support farmers. It's a way to connect to what's going on in the fields. And for the team, for all the cooks, they're seeing like the most beautiful stuff come through every week, twice a week, if not three times a week. Well, when we're more open than we are now. And it really kind of creates that connection that helps the kitchen stay in tune with the seasons.
Definitely. So when you get home from the market, are you just chopping all those vegetables up? Do you sear them? How do they get incorporated into the gumbo?
Yeah, so this is something where I really feel like, you know, and it's a restaurant, but also it really applies to home cooking. Building layers of flavor is really simple. You'll need an extra pan or two to get messy, but we'll take, say, the broccoli might be cooked in salted water. And then we'll take the, maybe say, beautiful carrots or baby turnips, and we'll toss them in olive oil and salt and roast them. Sometimes we'll take new onions and we'll cut them and again toss them in olive oil and salt and char them. So you have some charred flavors, some sweetness from cooked vegetable, some roasted flavors, and all of that stuff kind of combines to give a dish that doesn't have a lot of fat in it or any animal protein whatsoever, a lot of depth of flavor like that people expect or want. And so it's very satisfying.
And what's great about this for home cooks is that once you have all of those vegetables, you can do so many things with them. You can eat them right out of the fridge. You can throw them in salad.
Oh my God, yeah, that's so true. So when we do it, we cook all the vegetables ahead. And by the way, like, you could char the broccoli and simmer the onions. Like, there's no rule about it, but creating different approaches to each vegetable, then you combine them all. And then, so that's what we do. We do it ahead of time, and it makes a really great chilled salad. So you can toss it with some grains, lemon juice, olive oil, and it's lunch. Mm-hmm. A few herbs. This way of kind of working with the vegetables kind of creates a lot of flexibility. Pasta, really anything. And so I would say for myself at home, like, I love these kinds of combinations because they just sit in the refrigerator. They're ready to go. You want it cold? It's good. You want it hot? Also good. And then the other great thing is you go to the farmer's market once, and even if it's once a week, like, everything's kind of tossed in olive oil. It'll be perfectly fine until the next time you go to the market. So you get it, you cut and cook, combine it, you throw it in the refrigerator. It's there for you. And so that kind of cooking is also very efficient, and it gets things right at the peak of when they're at their best, because, you know, the farmer's market, they've just pulled stuff out of the ground. You go to the supermarket and things have been sitting around a while. And so it preserves some of the intensity and the vibrancy of the vegetables. And then doing it only once also makes it a little bit more easy to kind of wrap into what your life is really like, which is probably, you know, a little bit more hectic than will allow for a daily cooking of a ton of vegetables.
Yeah, especially right now. Well, this all sounds fantastic. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Daniel Patterson, who, along with Keith Corbin, is a chef at Alta Adams in West Adams. They are open right now from Thursday through Sunday. I'm talking now with Romeo Coleman of Coleman Family Farms up in Carpinteria. And Romeo, you bring so many brassicas down to the market every winter. Give us a rundown of what you've got on the table this week.
On the table this week, we've got the two kinds of broccoli spigarello. We've got your normal baby broccoli, DeSico variety, Russian kale, and cavolonero. And those are a couple of the handful of brassicas we have right now.
Right. And the spigarello is such a fun variety. I understand you were one of the first farmers to bring it here to the market. What's the story behind your spigarello?
The story behind our spigarello is it was brought to us by a customer named Paul Schrade, who was back in the late mid-80s. He wanted us to grow this because it was such a fantastic vegetable. And, you know, being who we are, my dad readily accepted a seed and started growing it and grew out our own seed. And we've had it since the early 80s.
Wow. So it's still from that original seed?
Yes, still from that original seed. It has a wonderful flavor.
So describe it. It looks like a curly kind of kale, right?
It's like a long, leafy, curly kale. It's kind of acts like a rapini in the field, though, because the first bunches of leaves that you get are rather large. And then as it gets a little older, the plant more mature, then the leaves get a little bit smaller and skinnier. And it's like most brassicas, with affected by the weather, where when it gets cold, it gets a really good, nice flavor.
Right, yeah. So the winter weather actually makes brassicas sweeter.
Yes, it does.
And so what kind of, you know, here we don't get that much winter weather. What kind of chill is required for these?
But, I mean, it's not even whether you get, you know, cold and snow and all that stuff. It's just whether there's a temperature change. So it's a temperature change. If you start out in hot weather and it gets colder, then that's all it needs.
Right alongside the broccoli and the kale and the spigarello, you also have the what looks like broccoli with bright yellow flowers on it. What is that?
You are exactly correct. That is those are broccoli flowers from the baby broccoli plant that we harvest.
And how do you use those?
You could just throw them in salads, throw them in soup, on top of soup to decorate it a little bit. And it imparts a little flavor of broccoli, and then you get a little sweet spot in there.
Great. Well, Romeo, everything looks delicious. We're so happy that you're here.
Thank you.
That was Romeo Coleman of Coleman Family Farms up in Carpinteria. You can find him at both the Wednesday and Saturday Santa Monica Farmers Market. For the Market Report, I'm Jillian Ferguson.
Coming up, how a tiny cafe in Little Tokyo is keeping their family's recipes alive. Stay with us. I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. The mother. Depending on who you talk to, it takes on a different meaning. To a baker, it's for their sourdough starter. Speak to Enrique Alvera, and he'll tell you about his mole madre at Pujol in Mexico City. For Glenn Ishii of Gist Cafe in Little Tokyo, it's the mother of all chashu marinades, and it's been in his family for over 70 years. Glenn is here for this week's segment of In the Weeds.
My name is Glenn Ishii. I am the chef and owner of Gist Cafe in Little Tokyo. My grandmother started the restaurant before World War II. I was born in the 70s, and my father and my mother were doing the restaurant. And during that time, I was growing up as a kid, just, you know, being trouble in Little Tokyo. Went to college and things like that while my mother and my father were still doing the restaurant. And then my father passed away in the year 2000. So we closed the restaurant in the year 2000. And a couple years later, my uncle opened up the restaurant called Tokyo Cafe, where our existing location is right now. I wanted to do something on my own. So Caroline Shin and I partnered up and we opened up Gist Cafe in Little that location where we're at right now in Little Tokyo. My grandmother was known for this one dish called the combination, which was a chashu shumai, which was only done on Fridays. And then when my parents did it, they were doing it on Fridays and Saturdays. The food itself comes from China. It's a Chinese dish, which is a barbecue pork. And the Japanese just put their own twist on it when people put it in ramen, or people just use it in fried rice, chahan, or things like that. And now I took the chashu dish, since it's the historical from my family, and I put it into a hash, where more American dishes will be like a corned beef hash or a pastrami hash over eggs and things like that. And I made it into a more Asian dish because I'm Asian American. And we put chashu with potatoes and became the chashu hash. My grandmother started the base of the chashu marinade. And basically the base of the chashu marinade is very similar to a starter. And when you add flour and add water and you keep on adding it, you have one base and it just keeps on growing over age. Same thing with the chashu marinade. The chashu marinade doesn't grow like yeast or the starter, but you just keep on adding flavors to it. Basically, it's a secret formula that I will not let that information go. If it's your first time there, the best thing to order would be the chashu hash and the fancy French. It's our signature French toast. What it is, it's a brioche bread that's dipped in creme brulee batter, and it's left overnight. It soaks overnight. A normal day before the pandemic was I would get into work about 4:45 and start getting everything ready for the day. And it was a hustle during that time, especially on the weekends. The weekends were very busy. So it was a very fast pace. Not too much room for error because our kitchen is very small and our restaurant is very small. So we have to play Tetris in the refrigerators and all that kind of stuff. It's very difficult in a small restaurant. Now, during the pandemic, what's great about Little Tokyo, the community itself, our landlord is Little Tokyo Service Center, which is a nonprofit organization. And they, when the pandemic first started, they set up an organization or a program that actually helps the seniors in the community. So what basically they did is they started asking restaurants around the Little Tokyo area or in the Little Tokyo area to come up with menus and actually cook for the seniors. And what they did is actually came to the restaurant, they picked it up and they delivered it to the senior living homes that are in Little Tokyo. And that's what helped us out. And now, since the pandemic is still going on, they are still doing that program, but they're rotating restaurants in different times to help the businesses out. Outdoor dining was very difficult to say yes or no because we're running such a small crew right now, and I did not want to afford to anybody to get sick. If one of us were to get sick, we would actually have to shut down the restaurant for a couple of weeks because there's nobody else that can do it. Of course, we understand that the business, you know, you're looking to be busy and you're looking for revenue and things like that. But in the long run, I'd rather be safe than sorry. I don't even know if I have the right answers or the wrong answers or what I'm doing is correct or not correct. All I'm trying to do is just taking care of each customer one by one. We do have a lot of regulars, and especially when I brought back my grandmother's dish, because the seniors in Little Tokyo were customers of my parents and were customers of my grandmother when they were doing their own business. They remember good times. So hopefully myself, the only thing I could do for people is actually try to cook the best food that I can cook. And if I could do that and please customers or bring happiness to customers that way, then I feel great and I feel like I'm doing my job correctly. But that's one of the only things that I can do, is actually cook for customers to bring them happiness.
That's Chef Glenn Ishii of Just Cafe. His family has operated in Little Tokyo for over 70 years. Order and support by visiting JISTcafe.com. As you go about your pandemic restricted week, remember that we have the power to make things better. Smile at others beneath your mask. Let someone take the turn at a stoplight and give them a thumbs up. Reach out however you can to those outside your bubble with respect and kindness. Be safe out there. If you missed any of today's show, listen on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify. My thanks to the Good Food team, Jillian Ferguson, Laurel Garcia, Desmond Taylor, and Victoria Alejandro. Special thanks to Laura Kondarajan, Amy Ta, Kat Yor, Paul Smith, Kenny Ng, and Gary Masiha. I'm Evan Kleiman, and please forget your New Year's diet plans this year and keep supporting your local restaurants and bakeries. We need them to still be around in February when all our diets wear off. I'll be back next week with an all-new episode of Good Food.